I am not exaggerating when I say my coffee is my life. My brain doesn't come online until I've had that first amazing cup in the morning. And as writers who spend so much time and staring and thinking at a screen, you need that moment of ritual and focus more than anyone. For years, I was chasing that perfect cup, but between messy presses and clunky pour-over setups, I was spending more time on the brew method than at my desk. And if you haven't tried coffee made with an AeroPress yet, you are absolutely in for a treat. The AeroPress is a manual coffee maker, kind of like a French press, but frankly, it's just better. It uses completely unique brewing methods that combine the best of all the worlds: a little French press, a little pour-over, and a little espresso. This patented three-in-one technology gives you an exceptionally delicious and unique cup of classic coffee that you can only get with an AeroPress. And here's the coffee secret you need to know. AeroPress coffee is less bitter than coffee made with other methods. Because it brews faster, you can actually taste the delicious notes of the coffee you bought, things like the roast and the country of origin and that flavor profile. Instead of bitterness, you get incredibly smooth richness and body coming through that unmatched. This is the ultimate lifestyle hack for a writer because AeroPress was designed to fit your life. For the audience who spends hours in front of their computers, here's why the AeroPress Clear model is what you need. First, convenience. This is the fastest single cup coffee maker I've ever used. It takes about 2 minutes to brew and clean. That means less time futzing with gear and more time on your pages. Secondly, it brings consistently great coffee wherever you are. Maybe you're traveling for a conference, in a cabin for a writing retreat, or just working out on your deck. The AeroPress is compact, durable, and reliable, and it puts an end to bad coffee when you're on the road. It's the perfect, easy-to-clean solution for the office, your home desk, or anywhere your writing takes you. The AeroPress is shockingly affordable, less than $50, and we've got an incredible offer for our audience. Visit aeropress.com, TSNOTYAW, that's AeroPress.com/TSNOTYAW, and use the promo code TSNOTYAW to save 20% off your order. That's aeropress.com/TSNOTYAW, and be sure to use the code TSNOTYAW at checkout to save 20%. It's time to ditch the drive-through, toss the French press, and say yes to better mornings fueled by better coffee. AeroPress ships to the USA and over 60 countries around the world, and we thank AeroPress for sponsoring our show.
Have you been sitting on the fence about signing up for the Beta Reader Matchup? Or have you signed up before but haven't as yet found your writing soulmates? The next matchup is the last one of the year, so don't snooze on it. Get matched up with those writing in a similar genre and or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs. Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 2nd of November, with the matchup emails going out on the 3rd of November. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab. Please spread the word, even if you aren't signing up this time. The more writers we have registered, the better the matches will be, which means you'll be paying it forward to your fellow authors. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm best-selling author Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Cece Lira of Wendy Sherman Associates and Carly Waters of PS Literary. Hi, everyone. Today's guest's debut young adult novel, Me, Moth, was a finalist for the National Book Award and won the Coretta Scott King John Steptoe Award for New Talent, among many other accolades. Her second young adult novel, We Are All So Good at Smiling, was a School Library Journal Best Book of the Year and was praised for offering important messages uniquely delivered. By Kirkus Reviews, in a starred review. Gone Wolf, her middle grade fiction debut, was awarded the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and was named a Best Book of the Year by Publishers Weekly and Kirkus Reviews. And her second middle grade novel, Onyx and Beyond, was praised as a story of perseverance and love by Kirkus Reviews in a starred review. She lives in Charlottesville, Virginia. It's my pleasure to welcome Amber McBride. Amber, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being with us. That is one hell of a resume. It's not often I get to read author bios like that. Before we dive in, for our listeners, the book that we're discussing today, for those of you watching on our YouTube channel, is The Leaving Room. I'm holding up the cover, as is Amber. It is beautiful. Oh my goodness. It's just like, it's one of those books you just want to buy just because the cover's so gorgeous, and then you dive in and everything else is gorgeous too.
So before we start chatting about the book, I'm going to read you the flat copy so you know what to expect. So gospel is the keeper of the leaving room, a place all young people must phase through when they die. You see, the young are never ready to leave. They need a moment to remember and a keeper to help their wispy souls along. When a random door opens and another keeper named Melody arrives, their souls become entangled. There is familiarity between them. Are keepers allowed to fall in love? As they move towards each other, they realize they must also choose whether to hold onto life. With haunting encounters and a discovery of love in a novel that takes place in a span of 4 minutes, this is a brilliant depiction of strong young souls trying to claw their way back to a life with so many more adventures ahead together. And just for context, this is a YA novel in verse. Okay, so not something that we've discussed on the podcast before. So before we actually begin discussing this book in particular, I would love to hear about your journey to publication in terms of getting an agent and publishing your debut.
Ooh, okay. That was quite a journey. So I got my MFA right out of college. So I went straight from undergrad to get my MFA at Emerson College in Boston. And then I started teaching at the Furious Flower Poetry Center, which is the only Black, well, at the time, was the only Black poetry center in the United States. And the thing about when I came out of my MFA, unfortunately, this is like in 2012-ish, we weren't talking about diversity the same way and everything that we do now, we work on doing now. And so I kind of lost my voice in my MFA program. Often my critiques would have like slightly racially charged things happening. And so I kind of stopped writing for quite some time. And so when I was working at the Furious Flower Poetry Center, we were putting on a program called Sheer Good Fortune, where we were honoring Toni Morrison. And it was put on with Nikki Giovanni and Maya Angelou. And so I met all these brilliant writers, the people I looked up to my whole life, on the same day. And essentially, all of them knew I had gotten my MFA, that I wasn't writing that much. And they gave me the same advice, which was like, forget what everyone wants you to write, just write what you want. And soon after that, I started writing again. So after that, it still took me about 5 years to get an agent. And it still took hundreds of rejections, 2 full books written that didn't get to publication. So it was a very long road to get there. I think that people forget how much, quote, I don't call it rejection, but I think people like, you know, it takes a lot of no's to get to a, yes, I want to be rep by you. So, and then I ended up switching agents about 4 years ago too. So it's been a journey. It's been a journey.
Wow. I mean, that's incredible. And something that I've never heard before. So many people say that they went to do the MFA to find their voice, right? And that's where they found their voice. I've never had somebody say before, that's where I lost my voice. And I think that's just as important to talk about.
Yeah, but I think that I will say that a lot of people of color or queer people I know talk about it specifically in the time period I was going, right? Because like I said, we weren't talking about inclusion the same way we are now, lost their voice in their MFA programs. Or at least got to the point where they knew what they had to write for people to like it, and so weren't really being authentic to themselves. Like I remember very distinctly, I wrote a poem that was dedicated to Malcolm X, and the critique was, oh, I would like this better if it wasn't dedicated to Malcolm X. Like, I have so many moments like that that just invalidate myself, like, as a Black person, knowing Black history well, and it was just so much of me trying to teach people. Now, I do want to say my professors, John Scoiles in particular, Emerson College, brilliant, brilliant professors. It's just that you have to work in a workshop environment where they're not going to be as, you know, your professors are your professors for a reason. They understand the complexities in poetry and everything like that. But with my peers, it was really difficult.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the thing, because you're in this kind of workshopping experience and you're wanting good feedback. It's already so difficult to be making yourself vulnerable and open yourself up to critique. And of course you want good feedback. And then when you find yourself adapting your voice or what you're writing so that you can get the good feedback, it's just so counterintuitive. It's terrible.
Right. You're like going in circles. So yeah, it was an experience. But I do think that it's really important for anyone who is like listening, thinking about MFA, is to really do the research. Like, look at the professors that you want to work with, because it will make or break your MFA program. And so really considering that before you jump in.
Yeah. Okay, so before we start discussing The Leaving Room, I'm going to ask you to read the first sort of chapter. Can you first describe for our listeners who aren't familiar with, you know, a novel in verse, what that is about, just so that they understand that before we actually dive in?
100%. So a novel in verse is a novel written through poetry. It's written with line breaks, using a bit more creative kinds of forms, because your word count is going to be almost a quarter of what a regular novel would be. And so it should sound, or it sounds poetic. My students have said before, it's almost like a modern-ish Shakespeare, right? So it almost sounds like a play, the way that it's set up. It's really meant to be read. And yeah, so I think the mode works really, really well for reluctant readers, for people who want to read something short on a plane ride. And it's fun because you get to be more creative with how you're letting the story unfold.
Right. So for our listeners, you're going to hear Amber reading it. And so it's going to almost sound like prose, but the way you see it on the page is very much like poetry. Right. So there we go. And I'm going to show up like some examples here. So for those of you who are not watching on YouTube, I would suggest you go and have a look on YouTube so that you can actually see the form of the words on the page. Okay, Amber, will you please read those for us?
All right. The first one is called The Gospel Keeper, Rule 1, Do Not Lie. Time might not be significant everywhere, but rules must be followed and memory must be recorded. The thing is, no memory recalls itself exactly correctly. So at the center of every good telling, there is the smooth marble of a lie. Most soulful things lie. Think of violins, innocent-looking instruments of the living. Their thrum struts into any melody, smaller than atoms, kissing the infinite parts of air. Think of their hum, how it gently vibrates the nerves of the skin like pennies scraping stones on their descent into a wishing well. Sometimes I think I can hear them, the violins and the clicking of pennies, which should be impossible because this is a truth-filled place and keepers can't lie because keepers don't have living souls. Keepers are only atoms, matter, and some otherness. If you open us up along our double-stitched seams, I believe only fireflies would flutter out. My Gospel's Leaving Room. Rule 2, only one leaver and one keeper in a leaving room at the same time. The room I keep is small. Some might call it a closet that you can't escape. Square with sky-high ceilings, warned by a hearth, I whisper into each night. Framed paintings and sketchings line the walls, and a green-as-grass kitchen hugs the back wall, because those not ready to leave still think they need to eat. You'd think that if you wanted someone to leave, you'd make the cushions sink, make the food cold and bland, craft the room dark, and give the paintings off-putting smiles. Perhaps other keepers do this, frighten leavers into fleeing, but only children come to my leaving room. And children require dessert, moonsets, and warm blankets. I don't know what happens in other rooms, because there can only be one leaver and one keeper at one time in a leaving room. This is one rule I have never broken. So I keep the kettle hot, I collect recipes, I flood the cot in the corner where some leavers pretend to sleep with quilted blankets. My chair that rocks on half moons is stationed at the enormous stump named Methuselah. I know the stump is wounded. I don't know why. Changeful bruises cycle through it from bluish yellow to purplish green. Then they heal and rewind and starts again. It is as if it has been struck by some mythical axe. Methuselah marks the center of the leaving room, a wooden compass pointing everywhere and nowhere. A mancala board is carved into the ancient veins of the stump, a tattoo of chance with playing pieces that have been known to morph on their own accord. There's an alchemy to being a keeper, because I also must keep the tears from running too hard, prevent shouts from spilling through the seams like a stream. I must charm the ceiling to blink with stars and convince the paintings to offer reassuring nods. There are rules in death. You can't go back.
even though there are hundreds of paintings of everywhere places, there are no doors.
Amazing, amazing. I get goosebumps. I had goosebumps when I was reading it on the page, and I have goosebumps listening to you. It's incredible.
Thank you so much.
So can you tell us a bit about the inspiration of this? Because I loved reading your author's note about what inspired this.
Yes. So this was a long time simmering. When I was in college, my dad had a near-death experience during what was supposed to be a pretty routine surgery. And he later told me about essentially having an experience where he was floating above his body and his aunt, or his grandmother technically, called him back to his body in the same way she used to call him when he was a kid, because he would sleep in. He's a city boy, so he loved to sleep in. And so his grandmother would always call him once, twice, and on the third time she kind of yell it, and he would like jump up and be like, I'm awake, I'm going to school. And so essentially he said he was like floating above his body, and he heard his grandmother's voice kind of behind him once, twice, and on the third time he woke up back in his body. And so it made me start thinking about like, what is this liminal space between life and death? And so the idea came to me again. I used to be a professor at the University of Virginia before I resigned last year. And unfortunately, in 2022, there was a school shooting that resulted in the death of 3 students. And for me, I think that anybody who works with young people knows that they're like brimming with life. And so this passing of these 3 students was so difficult to navigate with the student body, but also as a professor. And I started thinking again, like, is there this place that holds you like right after, especially for young people who have so much life left? And then I hoped that this book would kind of open conversation about death and the afterlife outside of religion, right? Like outside of whatever you think is after this. But is there a moment where you acclimate that, because death feels like a very sudden thing? So that's kind of the progression of creating this book.
Wow. Yeah. So there's so much to unpack. I mean, a book that takes place in 4 minutes, you know, as well. It was like, I think the most I've seen in terms of time frame with a book is like a book that takes place in a day, you know, and then you feel like, oh, wow, they've really like milked this day. But, you know, in terms of trying to do that in prose would be virtually impossible. It would be the most boring book that ever was. People would just be like, there's nothing happening here. But poetry is about capturing a moment. So much of it is about that. So can you speak a bit about your background in poetry and how that influences your storytelling?
Spot on the idea that like poetry is like so in emotion. So we can sit with emotions for so long. In prose, like if you sit with emotions, it gets telly on what you want us to think the character is feeling. And so for me, verse, because I'm originally a poet, it's the idea that so much, like you were saying, goosebumps. It's like almost like when we're listening to our favorite song and we don't know why we get goosebumps, but it's hitting at a nerve or something that feels so human. And I think that poetry does that. It's like reaching at feelings that don't necessarily, like everyone's used like the analogy of the stars being like fireflies. And we all know that might be cliche, but it invokes something in us because we're taking something that when it's pitch dark outside and you see fireflies, they do look like stars, right? And so it's these things that we all have experienced, and we can imbue our own emotion into it as well. I think that's the beauty of poetry. It invites you to put your own experiences into it to bolster that feeling. And so when it came to writing in verse, it was also putting that narrative arc in there, because I've written a poetry collection. That's different, right? Like you have a poem and it stands alone and they kind of loosely go together. But making sure characters change from beginning to end, making sure there's still a narrative, is the huge challenge for me when it came to switching to writing an actual like kind of novel in verse. But yeah, I think that for me, poetry is my first love. It's the thing that speaks to me the easiest. And so my only novel, Gone Wolf, which isn't in verse, was like rough. I was like, there are so many words here. Like we have to describe the setting fully. And so that was one of the bigger challenges. For me, describing something using poetry almost feels like breathing. It's very second nature to me.
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking, I sit as a novelist and I sit down for the day and I give myself a word count sort of goal, you know, 500 to 1,000 words. And I feel like I've done stuff. And often I'll just be wordy for the sake of being wordy so that I can hit my damn word count. But that's the whole thing about poetry, is there's an economy of language there that you don't see in prose. It's about capturing something in fewer words rather than more words. So can you tell us about your approach to the craft of writing when it comes to something like this? Do you plot everything out? Do you know what's going to be where? Is it kind of pensing and seeing where it goes? Can you tell us a bit more about that?
For me, I'm a pantser, so I'm just going with the vibes and hoping for the best, right? And it's really intuitive in it. Now, I will say for The Leaving Room, this book, and for Me Moth, my debut, I knew how the book was going to end, but I just was working towards that ending. And so for me, when I sit down, I don't really have a word count in mind when it comes to poetry. It's more of, can I get through this scene, this moment? And I tend to be a very fast drafter. And I think the immediacy of like staying in the verse for the first draft is important to me. And so I do put up pretty big word counts, even though it is verse. But I really kind of just feel through the story and hope for the best, which does mean on the back end, I'm doing a lot more editing than the average person. Because you do have to go back and you start to pull out things, right? Like, oh, when I talk about memory, I'm using a lot of scents. So like, let's use smell more. Let me pull that out more. Or, oh, when I'm using this one girl, she does have very sticky kind of word.
Hey, everybody. Guess who's back from France? I was thinking of you guys listening to me talk about getting ready for the trip and practicing my French while I was doing my best order en français at the cafes. It went well. I was a bit nervous, but when we were in the countryside and I could take my time thinking about what I wanted to say, I was able to say it. Being a bilingual family is high on my list of things that are super important to me as a parent and a mom. If we're going to show them the world, we also need to appreciate and respect the language and culture by learning it. Imagine how much richer your travel experience could be if you could speak the local languages when you travel. With Rosetta Stone, you'll gain the confidence to have real conversations and create deeper connections wherever you go. Rosetta Stone is the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb and retain your new language on desktop or mobile, whenever and wherever it fits your summer schedule. With 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more, Rosetta Stone is the go-to tool for real language growth. You can learn faster and retain longer. There's no English translations. You truly learn to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. There's an intuitive learning process. You start with words, build to phrases, and progress to full sentences. It's designed for long-term retention, so it sticks with you. You can work on your accent with the built-in True Accent speech recognition technology, so it'll help you sound more natural. You can learn anytime, anywhere. It fits with your lifestyle with a flexible on-the-go learning style, desktop or mobile app. And there's incredible value. A lifetime membership gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. The Shit About Writing listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/ today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/ today and start learning today.
The holidays sneak up fast, but it's not too early to get your shopping done and actually have fun with it. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts that you can't find anywhere else. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S. Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, and because they're made in small batches, best finds can sell out fast. I was on the site getting some ideas for my boys' Christmas gifts, and I spotted this bedside caddy for their books made of repurposed quilts, which was stunning and so practical. It tucks in between the bed frame and the mattress, has tons of pockets for notebooks and books and pencils and water bottles. All of us can go to any other old website and get something that was made quick and cheap, but a unique quilted item that has personality and is one of a kind because they're made of random fabric, that's on my list. My older son just learned how to fully read on his own. I know, I'm obsessed with this. And he needs a place to tuck his books when he's done for the night. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads and kids and teens to book lovers, history buffs, and diehard football fans to foodies, mixologists, and avid gardeners. You'll find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses, and many of these products are made in small batches. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3 million to date. So, shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/tsnotyaw. That's uncommongoods.com/tsnotyaw for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods. We're all out of the ordinary.
Language. Maybe her name should be Maple instead of this. That kind of stuff I start to like tease at as I edit.
I'm quite surprised that you say that you draft quite quickly, because people I know who write poetry or who write so beautifully that it feels like poetry You know, I'll be sitting across from them and we'll be having a writing session and I'll get to write 500 words in an hour and they will write sort of 50 words, but they are so particular about those 50 words. So, you know, it's interesting that you're able to really draft quickly, which means that you are able to get the critic's hat off. And that's so important when we write, because too many times we allow the critic to creep into the drafting phase and then we're like, no, that's not good. And that's not the right word. And that's not the right word choice. So I love how you're able to just draft quickly, which I think means you're not allowing the critic in the room.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. I think that for me, I write very quickly. I put out a lot of books in the last however many years and people ask me how I do it. And I say my biggest superpower is when I'm drafting, I don't critique myself at all. I mean, there's times where I'm like, that is a horrible line. I don't care. Let's move on kind of thing. And so I just take that out of it because I think that everything has to be done badly before it can be done well. And I really, really lean into that. So my friends, it's actually funny because my friends who write in prose actually joke about my high word count. So if we like sprint together, I can often get more words than them. And so I usually draft a verse novel in a month, first draft. And so then I go back and obviously I work with it for quite some time, but like first drafts, I can get out really quickly. I think I get tedious where people are talking about when I'm like getting meticulous about the actual line and the structure. But my first drafts generally are I'm still putting up 500 to 1000 word days in verse, which I mean, I love. So, but it's getting the critic out of your head. I think that this idea of perfection at first draft does not make sense. Even in sports, people have to practice and everything. And so I was a ballerina for 18 years. I look at it like that. Like when I first learned the choreography, I'm not good at it. I can't imbue that much emotion into the movement. It takes time and you have to allow yourself that time. You have to allow yourself grace to create something that you can be proud of.
Yeah, it's amazing how much time it takes to make something look effortless, right? So you see somebody do it, and whether it's a writer or whether it's somebody who's an Olympian or whatever, you know, you just go, oh my God, they make it look so easy. But it's hours and hours that go into that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that is a great way of putting it. Yeah.
How important is reading aloud, your own work aloud as you're drafting it? Because it's something that I say to a lot of my students is that it's so important to hear the words, to hear the cadence and the rhythm of the words. And especially if a scene becomes really fast and action fueled, as opposed to when it's more meditative, take your breath, let's regroup kind of scene. And for me, I get the most out of my work after I've drafted and edited, and then I'm reading it aloud. So I imagine with verse, it's got to be the same or even more important.
Yes, definitely. So for me, I'm always reading the lines aloud, even from the early drafting part we were talking about, because I think poetry is meant to kind of be read. And you do, like you're saying, you catch so much plotting, you catch repetition. It's like things you don't notice when you're just reading in your head that when you're speaking it, you're like, ah, that doesn't work. Or, ooh, wow, that sounds good together. And so, yeah, I read my books aloud a lot. And I think that even more so now, because I think I'm on my fourth audiobook that I've done. Even reading aloud meticulously is something that doing audiobooks has taught me, is that having a director pointing out where they think the emphasis is, and then you're being like, I don't know that I thought that. It makes me look even more closely at my verse. That's really helped me. And I think that when I did this audiobook, I saw that because I remember when I was reading it to myself, like, ooh, that's not going to sound great on audio. And so like, it's so many aspects that come into the crafting of poetry, but reading aloud is definitely something that's very important. It also makes for very clean drafts. I don't know if you notice that, like you catch a lot of errors when you're reading your work aloud.
Yeah, because you skip all of that when you're just reading it on the page. And some people say, okay, make the font bigger, change the font size so that you aren't skipping past the mistakes and stuff. But to me, nothing works as well as reading it aloud. So can we speak a bit about the world building with this book? Because it was a lot of world building, you know, in terms of figuring out the rules and how the world works. So what was your approach to that, especially since you're a pantser? Was it, I'm going to get there and then I'm going to figure out how the world works? Or was it that you kind of knew how the world works and then you were figuring out the plot as you were going along?
For me, it was definitely, I have no idea how the world works. I know how I want it to look. Let's just see how it goes. Because there was another aspect to the creation of this that I always forget to mention, is that while I was going through all this and these things were happening, I started working on a puzzle of a girl who was in a room by herself with a wolf, and there were lots of books and there were like fish outside the window. It's very like surrealist. And that was kind of the reference spot for what a living room might look like. And so it was just every fanciful thing I could think of. I was like, does it have the Beauty and the Beast aspect of a giant library? Does it have this Southern Gothic aspect? I'm from the South. And so imbuing that, the rules actually came along when we talk about fun of drafting, when my editor was like, listen, Amber, there's a lot happening here. We've got to ground this a bit more. And I was like, what if there are rules? And she was like, that would really help, because especially like explaining to the reader what's at stake in the beginning. And so that comes along. And so I love how collaborative writing a book with an editor you trust can be, because they know your style. They're not trying to change it, but they're like, hey, this is how we can make it better. So that's when the rules came along. But the idea that it happened in 4 minutes, that was something that was also I knew from the beginning, without giving spoilers, because there were certain aspects that I had known how the end was going to be. But in general, it was just, I really do feel my way through things. And so later I'll be like, okay, well, I didn't actually describe the room. Maybe I should do that, right? And then how the room changes through the season. What does that feel like? And, you know, I put like a YouTube video of fall up and just listen and like remember what it sounds like, that kind of stuff. Really trying to get into the nitty gritty of it. And then one fun thing I did do with this one, because memory and smell are so closely related, there's a lot of like smell kind of descriptions, is that I went on my favorite perfume website and I was just like reading how they were describing certain scents. And I like had a list of like words I really liked. And I was like, okay, what ones of these actually work in the story? So it was trying to really create something that felt very lush and very full, even though, like you said, it's only happening over 4 minutes and it's only happening in essentially a room. How do I keep that interesting and engaging?
But also with this kind of book, there's like a sense of timelessness, even though it is only happening in 4 minutes and you know that about the place, like there's a sense of time being suspended. And I love what you just said now about having a YouTube video of fall leaves, etc. Because when I'm writing a dark and stormy night, I listen to thunder and lightning and I have it flashing so that that feels authentic to me. And I love to light candles as well. If I'm writing a forest scene, I'll write light something that like smells like cedar or whatever, because that really makes something come alive to me. And I've got tons of vision boards as well, you know, so that I can describe something while looking at it. And I love that you do the same thing.
Do you ever do playlist as well for like music aspect? Yeah.
But some books, but not all books. It's so interesting. I've written one book that the whole book needed an entire playlist. But the next book, there was no playlist at all, except for sound effects. So it's like every book teaches you how to write it.
Yep. Every book, a different journey. Yep.
Yeah. Geez. Well, I mean, this is okay. We've come to the end of our time, unfortunately. For our listeners, even if you are not a poetry person, even if you're not a verse person, please go and get this book. We're linking to it on our bookshop.org affiliate page. You get the book there. You support an independent bookstore and the podcast at the same time. This is the kind of book you want to add to your collection and you want to savor it. The words become like these, like hard candy that you want to just rub all over your tongue and just suck it until the flavor's all gone. It's just, it's incredible. So please go and get it, even if you aren't poetry people, because it teaches you about language, about the best use of language. And yeah, I just absolutely loved it, Amber, and we wish you so much success with it.
Thank you so much. And I just want to say thank you so much for having me. I listen to this podcast a lot, well, especially a little while back. So I just really appreciate you having me. And thank you again.
Amazing. That's the best compliment. Thank you.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Have you been sitting on the fence about signing up for the Beta Reader Matchup? Or have you signed up before but haven't as yet found your writing soulmates? The next matchup is the last one of the year, so don't snooze on it. Get matched up with those writing in a similar genre and or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs. Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000 word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 2nd of November, with the matchup emails going out on the 3rd of November. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab. Please spread the word, even if you aren't signing up this time. The more writers we have registered, the better the matches will be, which means you'll be paying it forward to your fellow authors.